Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to another of the lost episodes of Early Work. If you're new here, Early Work is the show in which I invite a celebrity guest to share with me the creative writing of their youth. Be it teenage song lyrics, adolescent poetry, short stories and scripts, all sorts of stuff. Occasionally it's erotica, absolutely disgusting. People bring it on, I then judge it on three categories. I then read something of mine in return, they judge it in return, and we all have a lovely time and analyse our former selves and see if we showed any real potential. These are the lost episodes. They are the episodes I recorded in 2021 for a series that never came to be, finally being released now. So they were in the sort of height of the pandemic. I think it was around lockdown 3 that we were doing these remotely. Today's guest is Tom O'Dell. He's in a very fancy shed, as is explained at the start of this podcast, and I'm in a less fancy shed chatting to him from across London. Very thrilled that Tom gave up his time to be on this podcast. It's a very interesting, very insightful episode. Genuine music is played. He has a piano and he plays us actual songs that he wrote when he was younger, as well as sharing just some lyrics without the melodies. He actually plays us. He plays us out on a genuinely beautiful song about a spider. In the meantime, I'm still on tour. If you're looking for something to do, most of the tickets are sold out, but there's still some available in places like Barnard Castle. I'm not going to make the joke. Also Hexham and Coventry. You know, the big hitters. So if you do want to come along to that, the show's called Spilt Milk, stand-up comedy show. But in the meantime, here is the early work of the incredible Tom O'Dell. Joining me this week on another episode of Early Work is the one and only Tom O'Dell. Tom, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, welcome to the show. Now, if you don't know Tom, listeners, which of course you know Tom, but if you don't, he's probably best known for when I read about him having a shed that he was working in at the bottom of the garden. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I've got a shed that I've been working in at the bottom of the garden. And then I saw a picture of the outside of his shed and it is a billion times better than my shed. And I was furious. But Tom, you tell me that you've moved from that shed now. So that even that wasn't good enough for you, was it?
It was getting pretty cramped in there, yeah. I was mostly because through lockdown, I've managed to teach myself to produce records. So now I needed something a little bit bigger where people come and visit and stuff.
So the studio I'm looking at you in now over Zoom, is that in a building?
It's in a building now, yeah.
It's inside a building.
I literally moved out and my girlfriend moved in to the shed. She's an artist, so she destroyed the top floor of the house and now she's going to destroy the studio.
Oh, so you've swapped. Have you swapped studios?
Well, right. I've moved out to somewhere else and she's moved in to what was where I did my album.
So did you spend lockdown then writing, recording in that shed?
Yeah, and also, I gave up smoking 7 months ago, 8 months ago, but I used to just sit in there and smoke cigarettes. I mean, I it's definitely gonna kill me. Because there's no ventilation, so it's like I just sit there, smoke cigarettes, and record. And Georgie, my girlfriend, would open the door, and she'd be like, "This is disgusting. Like, just smoke would spew out that had been in there since 10 o'clock in the morning."
But what a rock star! I mean, it does sound like the idea of opening a door and just like you can't even see anything. It's just a thick fog, and you're like passed out on the floor. But you're clutching like a CD in your hand of this album you've just pressed. Oh, what a story. The last thing he ever did was press export.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if only it was that romantic.
Now, Tom, if I had to guess what you were like at school, and I do because it's the first format point of the show, what I would say is, and this is what I've written in advance, and this I say this most weeks, to be honest, but this is one of the hardest I've found to do this. So let's see. I've covered a lot of bases here. But I've opened with shy, reserved, secretive. At a younger age, I can imagine you voluntarily locked in your room in the Bo Burnham sense of the phrase, possibly squirreling away some creative stuff that you never
Who's
told
Bo
anyone
Burnham
about.
Again? Who's
Bo Burnham? Burnham is an American comedian. He just did a special and it had a song in it called Locked in a Room, which is why that phrase is in my head. Right. But he was like, from a young age, would be locked in a room, squirreling away some creative stuff that I think you probably never told anyone about, hopefully until today. I can imagine you going down sort of YouTube rabbit holes for a long time, but you're my age, so this was pre-YouTube. So it would have to be a YouTube equivalent, which for me was like Ebaum's World, or I guess like Napster, or like a GeoCities rabbit hole. I don't know if they exist, but something where you were just losing yourself in whatever the sort of 90s, early noughties internet things were. I mean, in fact, I think you wore your heart on your MSN screen name is what I've gone for. I reckon.
Line.
Oh yeah, exactly. It sounds like a lyric, doesn't it? I reckon the screen name was lyrics, broken heart emoticons. I could even see you signing in and out of MSN just to get the attention of someone who was logged in, who you fancied, so that they would start a conversation with you.
Very sad existence.
This was just me, to be honest. Don't worry. I wouldn't be surprised if you drafted some homemade Valentines for people you loved, and then didn't give them to them. I don't know, I've just got this idea of you being secretive and like doing stuff and not giving it. But then I'm going to change tact here. As a younger teenager, I'm going to wager that you are pretty loyal to Quiksilver, Billabong and Rip Curl as your clothing brands. I can see you as a sort of like 14-year-old, shorts and a hoodie and a friendship bracelet on a summer evening in the park, having a disposable barbecue with four friends. Then, as you get older, I can see you in a sort of school common room at 17, one leg crossed over the other in an armchair reading the paper. And other people being like, because people didn't do that at 17, so people finding that shocking. Possibly experimented with a bold fashion choice around this age, like a silk waistcoat or a cravat. And my final two predictions are, I think you learned how to surf, and I reckon your childhood email address was hosted on a very random server like AOL or Tiscali. Is any of this correct?
Where do I begin? So let me start this. So what was your initial one? Was the shy,
reserved, locked in a room?
Yeah, I don't think I was that, actually. I don't think I was. I think I was more what's the extroverted. I think I was a little bit more. I had more friends when I was particularly younger. I used to enjoy playing football and tennis, and I was quite sporty actually when I was younger, and. But I did the thing that you were correct about is I didn't tell people about my songwriting thing. Thankfully, I wasn't the guy that got the guitar out at the party to sing Wonderwall. Or at least I do have maybe some vague recollections of doing it a couple of times. But I think I learned very quickly that it didn't go as I maybe had expected to.
Also, it's such diminishing returns, isn't it? Like, the first time you do it, people might be impressed and excited. The next time, it's like, yeah, all right, mate.
Yeah, there was a guy called Dan, actually, that used to do that, who was in my class, and he used to do it. And
did he go for Wonderwall? Was it that cliche?
I think he went for the Goo Goo Dolls.
Of course, that was the era. That was the era.
Which is, I was on TikTok the other day, and I saw that song, like, trending again. I was like, Jesus Christ,
everything comes back round. That's how old we are now. You're 30, right?
Yeah, 30? I turned 30 last year. Yeah.
I mean, it's now at the time where the way young people dress. I mean, I'm literally sound like my mum now, but the way that everyone's dressing, the things people are listening to, you're like, yeah, well, we did this. I did this when I was 11. And then people are just like, oh, yeah, whatever. Of course you did.
Yeah. No, it's great. What was the other thing? There was some weird accuracy that you got at some point, and you literally described one evening.
From your reaction, it was the like Quicksilver Billabong Rip Curl, that Park barbecue, disposable barbecue with four
disposable
friends.
Barbecue thing. Yeah, that was like, I saw an old friend last night, and I've known her since I was 12, and we were literally talking about that. Like, I remember we went to the park, and we caught the bus there, and we had a disposable, and I was wearing a brown hoodie, and I had a piece of string on my.
Yes, a friendship bracelet. Yeah. Close enough.
Mate, honestly, that is so weird. That's so weird you got it so well. And I did get into surfing. And what's quite funny is I got into surfing at East Wittering, which is near where I grew up. And, you know, the waves like rarely get over like a foot. So it's freezing. So it's like not really like I used to think I was very cool. Drive down in my grandmother's Skoda, which she lent me with my surfboard.
Well, I just... the surfing thing, this all bled into the same thing. So the surfing thing was based... Primarily, it was based on the hair that you used to have, which you now have cut. You don't have that hair anymore. But I was like, you're not having that hair and you've never been on a surfboard. Come on. So that's what I based it on. And then I looked up... I was like, would it be surfing or would it be like lacrosse? And then I looked up where your school was, and it wasn't. It was quite close to the sea.
Yeah.
It's like, so I was like, I'm surfing. And then that led into, well, you're wearing Quicksilver, you know, you're wearing all this, you're in the park. Suddenly I'm imagining, I don't know if you ever saw, they did a, do you remember when The OC was massive?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I mean, I forced myself to fucking watch that show. It was one of those things that I hated, but I watched because I thought that it was relevant to me.
Like, oh yeah, your life is represented when he stands up on a coffee cart and says, "I love you," just like we all did.
Yeah, that's how
I felt as well. I mean, everyone was obsessed. Did you watch it because everyone was obsessed with it?
And
it It was
like
the school's version of water cooler moments, wasn't it? Where it's you've got to come and talk about what Ryan and Marissa did last night.
Yeah, strange. I sort of like, I just my feeling about the OC was that I never liked it, but I spent a disproportionate amount of hours watching it for something that I didn't like.
Well, they did the real OC, the reality version of the real Laguna Beach or whatever, and then they did a UK knockoff of it called Living on the Edge about Alderley Edge near Manchester that was meant to be a version of Laguna Beach. But obviously, it's nothing like it at all. But it had that vibe of like teenagers who were really rich or whatever, and then they're just like hanging out. Yeah. And they all dressed like this, like I was like I was picturing. I didn't picture you in the same lifestyle. It's just the outfits. I was just imagining that, and then they all surfed.
It was One Tree Hill as well. That was another one.
Yeah, that was huge. One Tree Hill.
And there was others. Also, like, what was it? What was like the films? There was like American Pie.
I rewatched it the other day. It was on TV the other day, and I rewatched.
It's dreadful,
American
right?
Pie. It's unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable.
Totally, I mean, I can't believe those films haven't been cancelled.
Like, yeah, I mean, a big part of it is about setting up a hidden camera. To spy and live stream you having sex with someone. It's insane.
I know. It's gross, and it shows how much the world has moved on.
And that was
in a positive way. 100%. But yeah, it's funny because you don't see that guy. Because I remember having this huge admiration when I was like 14 for Stifler, you know. And I remember thinking like, God, he's so cool, isn't he? And then like I watched him in the film and I was like, God, what? Like, it's such bad male role models. I mean, no wonder so many men have problems.
Maybe the OC was actually a positive influence, given that they really portray Seth and Ryan as these positive romantics.
They were like fucking wet wipes.
So there's no middle ground. You need some middle ground. Someone who can carry themselves but isn't a horrible sexist bully. Why can't we have it's just one or the other.
I know.
The other thing I said was that you had you made a bold fashion choice at some age and went for it with like a waistcoat or a cravat. Is there any accuracy in that?
No, I never did that. No.
You play it safe.
No, I don't. I did get. I'm a bit of a news junkie, and I have been since I was 17. And I did used to read the papers, actually. And I did used to take a small amount of flack for it.
Yes, I did the same.
Yeah, I used to like...
Were you actually reading them, or were you just holding them and pretending to?
No, I did actually... I did actually like reading them. And I did... I feel like I used to think it was really educated, and now I feel like the opposite, reading the papers. It's like my sort of like dirty habit, like reading the papers, because it's just like there isn't really... Is it news anymore?
Yeah, well, that's like, it, isn't it? So I did the same in sixth form. I did a similar thing where they would put the papers out in this common room and like The Economist and stuff like that,
yeah.
And like This Week. And I'd read them, and you'd read them going, well, now I guess I'll sit here and read this book of facts. And then you get a bit older, you go through a year of that, or like you study anything, and you go, oh, this is a book of lies. This is a book of opinions. This is, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And then you went at that age as well, at 17, you're basically just like, you're looking for someone to kind of gift you an opinion you can say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sound smart. So I was just like reading them and then saying whatever this op-ed writer thought, and then realizing, oh my God, I've got the views of a 49-year-old man with a Jaguar. This is bizarre.
Yeah, it's so true.
Did you have, what was your email address when you were younger? Did you have a AOL or Tiscali or something like that, or were you Hotmail?
I've got the same email address. I can't. If I was to tell you, I'd get many emails. Well,
we don't have many listeners, so you would be fine. Yeah, fair enough. I was going to put in this guess that I felt you might have had strict-ish parents, only based on the glee with which you say the word fucking in Another Love. And it's like you're going, you're looking around all the time going, I can swear, right? But I don't know, maybe that was misjudged.
Not at all, actually. My parents were very, they're very encouraging of independence. They're very non-strict. Let me get away. Well, let me just get on with it, actually. I'm very grateful to them for that, actually. They really didn't... They didn't impart any opinion on me. And they brought me up very liberally. And you know, I think there's often a misconception about me as well, is that I come from this sort of aristocratic family. Like my parents, like, very middle class. Like, you know, I got to go to a private school, but not you know, because of any wealth. Like, went to private school, so I got a music scholarship, and like, I think not to get too deep, but I think like the residing feeling of my like upbringing is that I went to this private school, of which I was, you know, surrounded by kids that were having a lot more affluent upbringings than my own, and I think that always meant that I felt like a bit of an outsider, which I think probably was the reason I do this job, is because I think that is a predominant theme amongst people I've noticed who end up doing things like this. Like, you know, I didn't ever feel like I belonged there, you know. I always felt like a visitor. I always felt like, you know, I was, you know, I don't know. And I think I feel like sort of it was interesting because I think I feel that is in some ways, I think that's a positive thing actually to have as growing up, is feeling like you're at an arm's length to some extent. It allows you to observe things with a little more clarity, I think. And also, I'm very grateful that I got to have the education I did. But one of the frustrating things is people always assume my childhood was like my guy I worked with the other day, he was like, oh, I just assumed you grew up in some like huge Victorian house. I'm like, what?
it's kind of weird to picture someone's childhood house anyway, I think. But
yeah,
it definitely, being an outsider is definitely conducive to making art and going into a artistic and performing field. So how did all of this manifest itself creatively? I know you said that you were secretive about it, or you didn't tell anyone about it. Maybe it wasn't secretive, you just decided not to share it. But so what were you doing? Were you doing anything other than songwriting, or was it always just music creatively for you?
Yeah, I think it was creatively. I got in. I started playing the piano when I was when I was 7. In fact, you know what? I can give you one of these things that we're here to talk about now, which really relates to that. Do you want that now?
Yes, please.
It's a piano report from when I was 13.
What is a piano report?
So, from my piano lesson.
Oh, and you just get, this is like the teacher saying.
The teacher giving a report. And so I was 13, and the teacher's called Edward Hawkins, who actually I'm vaguely in touch with today. But he's a lovely, beautiful man. Like,
did you first name your teachers?
No, it was Mr. Hawkins, I think. Yeah.
Okay, just nowadays you're going.
Yeah,
for
it just says yeah, Edward. Yeah, yeah. Just fully naming him.
Yeah.
Because I can. So I'm in year 8 at this point, and the comments are, it was quite flattering, this. I mean, it rubs my ego off. It's like, Tom has firmly established himself as one of the most gifted young musicians in the school. His understanding of chord theory is particularly excellent, fueled as it is from a genuine love of playing and improvising. We are currently dividing time between jazz, pop, and classical music, and it is my hope that we can develop his technical skills so they are on par with his natural playing by ear. A pleasure to teach.
Oh, look at that. Year 8.
There we go.
That's so I like the piano. Encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah, so I was a bit obsessed with the piano from very, very young. And, from 6 or 7. And then I started writing melodies when I was like 10. And then, you know, I was doing it ever since then. And I'd get home from school every night and... we had a piano in downstairs, one of the rooms next to the kitchen, and I'd go in there for an hour and play the piano. And, you know, I did that all the way up until I left home. And it was actually only in recent years I've realised, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a sort of classic house in a cul-de-sac, like the kind of one you would draw if you're not very good at drawing, with a front door in the middle, two windows either side, two windows upstairs. It was like that, you know, like 3 bedrooms. And the piano was downstairs, and I got the piano bought for me when I was 11, or 10 or 11 by my grandparents. Before that, I had a keyboard. Anyway, but how loud it was, you know, because it was a modern house, and it was like, walls weren't that thick, and it's just the whole house. I had to listen to someone else playing it, and you realise, like, from the, you know, all to my sister, my poor sister had to put up with all this piano playing for 2 hours every night. And
I mean, at least it's pianos, though. At least it was piano music, not, but you didn't get into the bagpipes.
It's true. It is true, but it is loud. I mean, like, yeah. And it was consistent.
Also, yeah, I love that you say that people thought that you lived in a castle growing up and you actually lived in a child's drawing of a house. It's like, it's so far removed from everyone's imagination.
I don't know if people actually think I grew up in a castle, but I'm just going off like the fucking cynical journalist I don't know. I just feel like there's this sense of just like privilege, and I never really like addressed it or address it. I'm just always just a bit like, it's irrelevant, but I'm just sort of like, how do you know how I fucking grew up? Like, yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, there's this presumption of just like, you have no idea what it was like. And I find it sort of I still feel angry about some of the wrath of sort of journalists I've received over the years. I've just sort of like, the amount of presumption that goes on is just monstrous, you know?
And it must have been hard to fit in piano as well, like in between, you know, going out into your garden and tending to your horses and then counting your cash. But it's good that you did pursue something creatively.
You're trying to writing songs in the back of the Bentley. You have no idea how difficult.
It's amazing you're not a rapper, really, with all the stuff you could have talked about. But did you? So, do you have any early melodies that you wrote? Do you remember them? Any of them, or are they all out of your mind?
Yeah, let me give you one. So this was the first one I wrote when I was 8 years old, or 9 years old, or something. It goes. Thank you. because I'm in love with you. I'm in love and I don't know what to do. Look up to the stars and they can see a sign of blue. Anyway, that's one of them early ones.
Wow.
I got.
I mean, that's so... And you were 8 or 9?
Yeah, and I remember running in to the living room where my parents were watching TV, and I ran in and I said, you know, I've written this melody, like, and I remember them being genuinely impressed, you know, like genuinely impressed. And I think that has always stuck with me, that feeling.
I mean, of course they're impressed. I mean, I'm impressed now at 30 that you wrote that melody. It's amazing. Who were you in love with, or had you just heard that said in songs? You're 8 or 9. Were you in love?
No, I think I'd heard it said in songs, and so I really, like, the lyrical thing didn't develop until much later. But my mum, because I spoke to her last night, because I was trying to gather some stuff for this, you know, for today, and she said to me, because I lived in New Zealand when I was 4 to 5 years old, and I, she said to me that we used to go to, they used to go to friends' houses, and she bought me this little plastic guitar thing, and I would go around to all of the adults at the party and play for them and sing for them and ask them for money. Which is...
Wow. Especially given how rich they knew you were. they were going, how dare you? I saw what you arrived in. Yeah, that is so funny. I love that you were so, like, at the age where it mattered, you weren't getting a guitar out around the campfire and being a dickhead.
Yeah,
at the age where it's still sweet and innocent, you were just busking at parties.
Busking at parties, yeah. Yeah. And
did they give you money?
You know what? I don't actually remember. But yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's you know, it's strange that, because I feel like, as much as it's sort of like a little bit, you know, fucking over the top, because it's like, but I do feel like those early experiences you have as a child do... they do stay with you in a way that is very, very deep, I think, because I think you those mechanics of how you're communicating people, how you're getting gratification from people, I think they...
Oh, think if you're it, early, I suppose, yeah, if your early praise is, I've written this melody and this song, and then yeah, it's like, oh, they're really impressed, yeah, then you're going to go... It's your first, like, thing of being really impressed. You go, oh, right, I'll just do that. Mine was, I was Oliver in Oliver Twist. And obviously you're 10, so they're going to be really nice. Yeah. And then from that, it was like, oh, I need to be on a stage. I have to be on a stage then and do it and saying stuff, because that's the only way people go, oh, all right. Funny. Whereas there'll be people who are like, would play a really good football match or whatever, yeah, and everyone go, oh, brilliant. And they go, I've got to be a footballer. But which makes it, I mean, how'd you get into being an estate agent then? What, you showed someone your room? And...
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What was the first record that you bought? Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember, no.
Mine was Smurfs, Christmas, or it was Shanks and Bigfoot, Sweet Like Chocolate Boy.
I know... neither of those records.
You know, you don't know Smurfs Christmas? Come on, man.
How's that go?
I mean, I don't know how it goes. I just remember the Smurfs banging on about Christmas.
The Smurfs, I did like the Smurfs though. They were great. I'd like to. Have you gone on YouTube and watched any of these sort of like things you watched when you were four and haven't seen since?
No, God no.
It's very bizarre. It's very trippy actually, because you sort of like. I watched an episode of Winnie the Pooh the other day.
And is everything all right, Tom? has it been a weird year?
I mean, it's,
yeah.
It's where do I begin? It's what was strange about it is that it felt unfamiliar because I hadn't watched it for 25 years, but simultaneously very familiar, and you almost remember the plot. But like, it's so right. Weird. It's so strange how memory works. I'm sort of like a bit fascinated by it, particularly memories that you acquired when you were four or five. It's like memory works very weirdly then as well. You remember bizarre things, insignificant things.
Were you triggered into remembering, other than the plots, any actual things by watching Winnie the Pooh? I mean, like, they always do, like, it's the music and smell are the main things, aren't they, supposedly, for memory?
Smell's a big one, yeah. Yeah, I had a strange one where my grandfather, after he died many years ago, and then he had this sort of like notebook which I must have taken or something or got given it after he died, and it smelt of him. And like, what, 10 years later? How could something? It's bizarre. It's interesting. Yeah, smell is interesting. I feel like I've really lost my I must have got COVID at some point, because I feel like I really lost an element of my sense of smell this year.
Well, that'll be how you're able to smoke cigarettes all day in a shed with no ventilation. You'd have to lose your sense of smell to be able to go, this is fine.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm one of those like classic ex-smokers now that fucking hates people smoking near them. In this restaurant last night, I was getting really annoyed. This young kid with a mullet, it was just smoking a cigarette next to me, and I was like, oh, just like kept sending him daggers.
the good old days.
The worst. I can't. Ex-smokers are the worst. My dad's an ex-smoker as well. So I smoked for 10 years, and he used to get really annoyed at me smoking. Not just because of my health, but because it made him jealous, I think.
There was an element of envy in what you were saying about the kid with the mullet, I've got to say.
Yeah.
There was an element of staring daggers because you're thinking, oh, that could be me.
I could grow my hair out.
Exactly. Get the rip curl back, and back in the old days. Now, you've got have you got a lyric book? Did you say you've got a lyric book with you?
I got a lyric book, which I don't know what date this lyric book started, because I stupidly didn't date it, but I reckon I was 15.
And did you, were they mostly just lyrics, or did they all have melodies to them? Or did you...
Did you write
melody first and then write lyrics to the melody? Or did you ever just have ideas for lines and then you would do that first?
It was rarer I would write lyrics without melodies. It would usually be they would come at the same time. But occasionally there'd be ideas, as you said. I mean, they're fucking weird. What I was writing about when I was 15 was
go on. Let's hear some.
This is called Phoebe and the Gang. Warrior Jim counts 13 cheers. His teenage ones were his iconic years. He laughs out loud for Phoebe and the Gang. 5 more years until he can be hung, and Jimmy's mummy calls it 7 o'clock, but Jimmy knows the time because he's got a cult. He's got a gold Casio watch.
Wow, what era is this set in? I mean, what is it, 5 more years until he can be hung?
Yeah, it's just so random. Thinking back to that recollection, my eyes were down in the French detention. I laugh out loud, but no one hears the slang. Maybe in a year they will hear the question, is Jimmy okay, as he checks his stock? All I really think about is that gold Casio watch.
Oh my God, when you first said it's called Phoebe and the Gang and like the first couple of lines, I was like, okay, maybe it's like some Beatles inspiration here. And then the further it went on, I was like, well, I don't know what Beatles song this is.
I was very into David Bowie, I think, at this age.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I think that's what... This goes with your Billabong man, Billabong boy. This is called Ride. The waves are gentle, but we already know. They crash down. It's just no accident. The child knows. They crash down. And then we ride, and they let us get high. Oasis... This is awful. Oasis sighted. Oh, it's our culture. It's our common... good, and it's just ours. They already know. Hey, let's lose track of time. Let's just ride.
Wow, and especially imagining you were on waves that were sort of 3 inches high.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's just ride.
I mean, it's just dreadful.
As you paddle back to the beach, tail between your legs.
What I do remember though about this book, if I'm just giving myself a little bit, is I don't feel like this was a particularly positive time for my songwriting. As I'm reading this, I feel like a sense of sort of like, I think I was struggling at this age. Like I was, I don't know, like, I feel like at like 13, when I first discovered songwriters, there was like a real glory age. And then at like 18, 19, 20, but in between I was really trying to work out what I was doing. This one's called Retired Rockstar. So he's been wandering through his daily plans to find out what is missing. Nothing makes him feel so sad. Oh, it could be drugs. No, something makes him feel sad. Oh, it could be drugs. It could be rock and roll. It could be all those teenage girls he longed for years ago. Yeah. Oh, this one was a good song. See Yourself Dressed in Blue. I remember how this goes.
See yourself dressed in blue. See yourself wish for two. Talk about the equal lane. This is all a crowded game. These are the days we throw away. We are beautiful people, but we're beautifully fake about now.
It's that one.
Oh, amazing. Beautiful people, but beautifully fake. I mean, what... Do you know what year that would have been?
2004.
Yeah, so you're about 14.
Yeah,
15.
It's 2014, man.
Yeah,
you're just touring the fucking world, mate.
You had awards under your belt. I remember how this one goes. It's on several of my albums. It's available on Spotify. Great. See Yourself Dressed in Blue. Is that a metaphor?
Don't know. I have no idea.
That's the thing, isn't it? I find this with all this. You dig out all this stuff and you go, what did I possibly mean by that?
I've got a lot of these and they're mostly filled with rubbish, if I'm being honest with you, which is fine. And you know, like, I think it's important to if there is any young 14-year-olds listening, to it's the effort, I think, that is more important than the content or the action of actually doing it. Because I think you learn every time you write something, you learn, or just doing it itself, you know, is more important, I think, than... You know, everyone has to start somewhere, don't they? And it's usually rubbish unless you're Billie Eilish or
yeah.
And then the first thing you do is just...
That is frustrating, isn't it, when you see that? Because you think, you know, very rarely a song's going to be a first draft, and you have to write bad songs to write good songs. Same with jokes. Yeah. Same with any kind of writing. You've got to write bad stuff to write good stuff.
Yeah.
And then Billie Eilish comes along. And in her experimental era, she's the most successful recording artist
of all time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then again, you know, what I would say is, like, she has her brother's older, and her brother, she does write all her songs with her brother. And he, you know, is like a few years old. He's like 22 or 23 or something, isn't he? But which is still young.
Yeah.
But the point is that it's not just sort of like, often there is someone helping who has probably made the mistakes themselves as well. And
What I find is that when you're like 17 or younger, like this age, 14, 15, what you kind of need is for someone with a bit more experience like that to say, to give you the quality control that you don't have and say, oh, actually, what you're doing is this and it's, or it's derivative in this way. If you just do this, if you just pursue this bit, etc. But when you're 14, no one actively, people don't do that because they're trying to encourage your own creativity and pursuit. But they could like cut 5 years out if people just said, here's what's good, here's what's shit.
100%. I mean, the person that I was incredibly... I had a few sort of mentors I met when... I was very fortunate throughout my formative years that there was a couple of key people I met that really encouraged me to keep going. But one of the most significant ones was this chap called Simon Skinner, who... joined my school when I was 16 and set up a music technology department. And when I was 16, I was very shy and very, I really didn't tell anyone about what I was doing and kept it under real sort of close wraps and almost to the point of secrecy, I'd say. And I think that I was in a practice room at school playing the piano, and he walked past and he must have stood outside and listened, and he really he said to come and see him every week, and I did that, and he would sit and listen to my songs and encourage me to write more. And I have a lot to owe to him, actually, because I wonder if I hadn't have met him whether I would have I really do wonder if I would have done it, or would have been able to have the confidence to do it. He, funnily enough, coincidentally, had the exact same experience with Chris Martin 10 years earlier,
What this guy? This is like what a superhero comes in, sets up a music department, and then makes stars out of one person at the school.
Yeah, so he, 10 years earlier, he had, I think, almost the exact same experience, met Chris Martin when he was 15, like, mentored him for 3 or 4 years, and then Chris went off and formed Coldplay, and then he came to my school and did the same thing with me, and you know, I don't know, I have a lot, I need to speak to him, actually. I feel very like I have a lot to thank him for. And I've met Chris Martin at a restaurant quite a few years ago now, and I was talking to him, and we both established our connection through Simon, and it's interesting. Like, I don't know, it's like he's definitely got something to him. I think the interesting thing to me is that so many, actually, where I make mistakes with, like, for example, actually today I'm meeting a friend's, after this I'm meeting a friend's, a close friend of mine has got a niece who wants to get into songwriting, and you know, quite often, like, will have these sort of situations where I meet someone and they ask for advice, and I feel like I'm rubbish at giving advice, and I'm rubbish at telling people like what to do. And I think what's interesting, if I think back to what Simon did, Mr. Skinner did, is that he just listened mostly, you know, like that's the interesting thing. He just listened and encouraged and didn't, I think so many things in life can only be discovered on your own, you know? Like, it's not about just being... It's not about just handing a piece of knowledge down. It's just about encouraging something to grow and to blossom. And I think, you know, that's where he was incredible, you know? And the reason I sound quite melancholic about it is because, I feel like maybe I haven't been able to... The relationship is unique in the sense that it was a teacher, and so I moved on.
Yeah,
and so,
of course. Yeah,
do you know
what
I mean? And I feel like that there were limitations to that. That I think he it was, you know, but he's he what he has done. All my all my records I've made so far, I've always made piano books for. So, you know, like, that people can have on their pianos and learn. And he's always notated all the albums, and that's been really nice.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's an, that, I mean, yeah, that's a nice little nod.
Yeah.
A nice reference to it. I also love that you say, so you're meeting someone's niece who wants to get into songwriting. So that means, so your friend obviously said, oh, I've got a niece who wants to get into songwriting. Could you have a chat? I've had similar things where genuinely people go, oh, I've got this, you know, my mate or my little brother wants to get into comedy. Yeah, yeah. Could you give him James Acaster's number? Is what I have. Never do they go, Rhys, will you have a little chat to my brother? Because he's trying to be a comedian. They'll go, you know Ed Gamble, don't you? Can you, do you mind setting up a meeting? Absolutely infuriating. How dare you? Or like people go, friends of mine go, oh, I'm going to get some comedy, some tickets to a comedy show for my dad for Christmas or something.
Yeah.
And then they go, what would be good? I go, Are you fucking kidding me? You want me to just, what? You want me to give you the link to the comedy store, do you? Just obviously come to my show. What is wrong with you?
I like it. I have similar things when it's like occasionally, you know, you meet some, you know, second cousin or something. Like the first thing they ask is like, have you ever met Ed Sheeran?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Is it, yeah, I was going to say, who's the equivalent of the, do you know James Acaster? Is it Ed Sheeran? Is that the one that everyone wants to know?
I think so, probably throughout the years. Yeah, it's definitely being the one that I don't, or the funny one is like always like, what's it like being on Top of the Pops? And you're like, what?
Like... Right, it comes to the time now, Tom, where I have to score the work I've heard you do on three categories, right, out of five. Great. Each, and the categories are originality, pure teen horniness, and the Mickey Mouse Club / Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score, which is sort of how close is it to your work now? How much potential does it show for the star that we now know you to be? So, first up, originality. Now, we did talk about some of the influences in those things you read. You know, I certainly heard Coldplay even before you said Coldplay in that song. And, I mean, you were eight, to be fair. And I heard, I mean, that would be insane if you wrote the most original song of all time at eight with no influences. Yeah. And then Phoebe and the Gang. I mean, maybe there's some Bowie elements in there. But, you know, I liked how you were true to what I thought you would be, like, in your soul and your core, which is a billabong boy. And you really billabong boyed it. And you were truly yourself in the song Ride. So, and see yourself dressed in blue. Both of us don't know what that means. So that's got to be pretty original. So I'm going to go for a 3 out of 5 for originality.
Right.
Pure teen horniness. I got to say, mate, I didn't find any of it particularly horny. I don't know if you were intending horniness, but it didn't come across. There's one line.
I said my Stifler.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you're obsessed with Stifler. I did not see Stifler in the work, I've got to say. I mean, you bang on about a Casio watch for quite a long time. I mean, where's the horniness in that? So I
what you're doing with a Casio watch is the significant.
Well, where are you putting that watch? Maybe that's why you can't stop thinking about the Casio watch. In the last line of that thing. I can't stop thinking about where he put that. retired rock star, you did have a line about teenage girls, about all the teenage girls that he loved or whatever. So on that basis alone, I will give it a 1 out of 5.
It's very low score going coming in here.
I don't think people don't often want it to be a 5 out of 5 for pure teen horniness. So I think 10 is kind of the ideal score in this one, because you want 5 out of 5 originality, 5 out of 5 for potential. Unless you think the thing is bad, and then people don't want potential either. I mean, it's not bad to score low in this show. How much potential does it show for like Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score? I would say, you know, for the song you wrote at 8 to be I'm in Love with You. I mean it is sort of your first album, especially, was pretty heartbreaky. And if you're at 8 saying I'm in love with you, it does feel relevant. Same with like the one about see yourself dressed in blue, beautiful people beautifully fake. It feels a bit like, you know, stuff I've heard you say more recently. Not those words. I mean, certainly a more mature way of saying things. But I know your song Money in particular sort of like touches on this world a little bit more.
Yeah.
I don't really see Phoebe and the Gang in any of it. And I don't, you're not singing about surfing anymore. So there's certainly a mix. But I'll go for 3 again out of 5 Mickey Mouse Club score, which gives you a score of 7 out of 15, which is, you know, pretty respectable, mid-table.
Yeah, it's good.
You'll take it?
Yeah, I'll take it. Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, that's and fair. Now it comes to the time where I will read you something of mine, which you will then score on the same categories. Now, I am going to read you something that I wrote when I was a lot older than you were when you wrote these things. And it's because I saw an interview with you in which you were talking about how in the past you felt that your life had to be bad or you had to be feeling sad or heartbroken to be able to write good songs, which you, I think you said you don't feel like that anymore. But I had the same thing for a while, not with songs. But I wrote a thing for, this was a pitch for Sky Arts, where I was trying to write a show when I was about 21, 22, where all the dialogue rhymed. So the dialogue was, so it was like a drama sort of slash sitcom, but all the dialogue rhymed. And it was about a guy called Brandon James, who was a floundering writer. He, you know, he always did okay. Like everything he published, he got told he had potential. And then one night he was just like really heartbroken. So he wrote some blog post or something and woke up and it was hugely viral. And then he has to start seeking out, like his life starts going really well. So he has to start sabotaging his own life because he can't write good stuff unless his life's a mess. So every time he's something good starts happening, he on purpose fucks it up.
It's good.
But then it's like a weird, you know, but then you get more successful and then you have to fuck that up. And it was, it didn't really make sense. But there's just a scene. I just wrote this scene with a bit of dialogue where he gives some work to some guy who then, like his agent or whatever, who's then trying to explain to him, this is the moment he's trying to explain to him, your life needs to be shit. And this is the sort of realization moment. And this is like dialogue that rhymes. It's two voices. It will hopefully be clear what I'm doing. So I'll do it. Here we go. You ready? When you're at your lowest ebb, your pencil writes with the finest lead. What are you talking about? I write with pen. In fact, I just type. It's not 1910. No, it's a metaphor. Your writing is best when your life is a mess. You thrive in distress and rightful regret. The height of your success comes from one night of pure depression, so this is my lesson. Embrace it. Chase it. Pursue it and use it. Or stop. Pick your priority and stick to it honestly. This life is all about love. No matter how we try to distract ourselves, that fact won't budge. But unfortunately for you, it's one or the other. Red carpet hunger or a red-hearted lover. And God knows I won't hold it against you. From human to human, just do what you're meant to. And eventually, if it's meant to be, the rest just won't matter.
That's great. It's fucking random, but great.
It's mad, isn't it? This life is... Imagine, like, it's meant to be a conversation. Imagine if anyone said anything like that to you in a conversation. Even if it didn't rhyme. This life is about love.
What was the drive behind rhyming it?
The whole reason I was sort of asked to do it, I used to do some poetry things on stage and then someone said, why don't you write a thing that all rhymes? So it just came from a producer saying, why don't you just write something that rhymes? And then I think I did send this, a big document with all this sort of stuff in it to him, and I don't think he got back to me.
Oh no, that's so sad. If I think back to the amount of times when I was like trying to get my career going where for 4 years, I mean actually it's a relatively short time to compare to, you know, a lot of people, but like, you know, I think about this one time I made this demo CD. I found this guy that ran this bar in Brighton and he walked out of the bar and it was like the place to play in Brighton, you know, to like 20 people, but it was like the place to play if you get a gig there. And he took the CD, he was like, oh thanks mate, yeah I'll have a listen to it, and then walked down the street and then put it in the bin.
Oh my God. And
like, I will never forget. And what's interesting about it is just like the rejection of that, not to sound something like some sort of Hollywood story, but it's like, it really did drive me on. Cause I was just like, fuck you. Like I just felt so like, I'm going to prove you wrong. And, I don't know why I've sort of shamelessly and narcissistically brought it back to myself.
Famously you went and wrote the song Fuck You by Eamon, didn't you? And that's what inspired. You saw that guy, fuck you.
There was some Shakespeare I heard in your monologue because it reminds me of Shakespeare because he sort of wrote in rhyme.
That is far too high a compliment to say. This reminds me of Shakespeare. No one has ever said that about I've written before.
The sort of content, yeah. It was sort of like sort of deeper than normal conversation, you know, and it rhymed.
Yeah,
like, do you know what I mean?
Unrealistic.
It was like, unrealistic. Sort of, you know, I liked it. So what
it's
am I going to do?
It's certainly not iambic pentameter. It's all over the place on the page. But what you got to do is score it on the same three categories. So first of all, originality out of five.
I think definitely like four for that, I'd say, originality.
It's yeah, and bear in mind, this was pre-Hamilton as well. This is pre a whole show that rhymes. I hadn't seen that yet.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I think four, yeah. I mean, I've also like the content, the idea, like the actual thing you're talking about, it's like very specific and original.
Thank you very much. How about pure teen horniness?
None.
Yeah. There's nothing in there, is there?
Zero.
Well, there's the phrase red-hearted lover, but, right. Which is a bit probably Shakespearean, isn't it? Which, yeah. I mean, or everyone's heart is red.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm even getting at. But yeah, that's the closest thing. Red carpet What's hunger the... or red-hearted lover is basically a choice between, do you want to be successful and famous or do you want to be in a happy relationship? You can't have both.
Yeah.
An idea that no one has ever done before. The most original premise. And then finally, so I'll take a zero. I'll take a zero for horniness.
Yeah.
And then finally, it's Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score. How close is it to my work now? I mean, how similar is it to the vibe?
I've not seen your stand-up show, so I don't know if it's full of rhyming couplets and sort of slightly sort of like pseudo Shakespearean comedy.
Yeah, that sounds like a laugh, doesn't it?
I presume, seeing as you are a success, that it perhaps isn't. So I'd say, but I think in terms of like, you know, potential showing your talent, showing your versatility and you know, just pure way with words, I think it offers a lot. So I'd say a three.
I'll take a three. Okay. Well, look, very cleverly, what you've done is you've given me a 7 out of 15 and made this a very friendly draw.
Beautiful.
Isn't that? That's what it's all about. Isn't
that's
that
what
perfect?
It's all about.
7-7. And, you know, that means there's no winners on this episode. But the whole point of this show, anyway, is that we are both losers. That's the whole point of reading out early work. So now it comes to the time of the show where all that's left to do is for you to play us out with one last piece, with
Great.
One last thing of your choice.
Let me do that.
And give it the performance that your younger self might have wanted.
Let me set myself up here. So here we go. So I wrote this when I was about 15 and it was inspired by the spider that lived in my... the corner of my window. So yes, spider spins its web a little wider, sings, it says it's getting bigger, it doesn't know it's wrong. We shout louder, we feel ourselves growing stronger, it doesn't last any longer, we fall to the ground. I don't know why we have to die. This is once a dream and life goes on, and then we fall to the ground. And then we fall to the ground.
And then in the next verse is like, let's start living. Come on, girl, more winning. Lose yourself in emotion. Find someone with devotion. Never stop until you've loved someone. Never stop until they stop it. And never run until you've walked it. And then we fall to the ground.
this is once a dream. Life goes on, and then we fall to the ground.
And so on.
Oh my God. It's so good. I mean, absolutely beautiful.
Thank
that is
much.
So. Oh, 15 years old, and you yes. wrote that, and I read you something from when I was 21, and it was significantly worse. That was so. Not, I mean, that is a beautiful song, and it's probably the second song I've heard about a spider, and it's very different to Slipknot Spiders. It's very different energy. But oh, beautiful. Spin its web a little wider. I really love the line where you said, "Girl, more winning, lose yourself." Oh,
yes.
Look
yes.
at that.
Look at
someone
that.
Has figured it out at 15. But I would say, one thing I would say is that I Don't Know Why We Have to Die is a very sort of 15-year-old idea.
Well, I think discovering immortality for the first time was...
Exactly. Something. And through a spider.
I don't know. I definitely obsessed with death around that point.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of kids are when you sort of suddenly realise that you're not going to live forever. It's quite a disturbing thought the first time you...
You realising that as you look at a spider on your windowsill? I mean, what an image. What an image of a 15-year-old Tom O'Dell.
Yeah, it's a strange little creature, I think.
Absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us on Early Work.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
There it was, Tom O'Dell. How beautiful was that, man? Unbelievable. What a song that is. What a lovely guy to chat to as well. We'd never met before, never spoken before. It was all hooked up by Radio X. With thanks to Neil Fern, who did the lion's share of the edit on this, the main old edit, and then I did a little couple of tweaks in GarageBand. Go and check out Tom. I think he was doing some promo for a new album at the time. This obviously hasn't yielded that promo because it's 2 years later. But still, it was a beautiful album, so I recommend checking it out. There you go, promo done. I hope that spider track comes out on a deluxe version because I genuinely absolutely love that song. And thanks again for listening. Maybe if we climb up those sweet old charts, I'll book some more award-winning, brilliant musicians on the podcast instead of these dumb comedians. Anyway, next week's guest is Sophie Duker. See you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.